Hey everybody, this is Shannon with VIP Kid World, and welcome back. Some of you may know that I've been talking about a new series that I wanted to start for this podcast, and it's something that I hope that you'll be interested in, and maybe even if you are, you'll reach out to me somehow on social media, let me know what you think. Something I've been wanting to do for a while, even in my own personal life, had to do with book reading. I've always been really interested in that field, especially considering that my degree is essentially in speaking, radio. So the idea of reading a book has always really entertained me. So what I've decided to do for a few of these podcasts, I want to start something special, and I want to read a book. Now, if you've been to one of my workshops, you might have heard me talking about this book before, and I am sure that many of you have probably already read it yourselves. If you haven't, well, you're in for a definite treat. So for this new series, I am going to be reading, you've probably already guessed it. The title of the book is Little Soldiers: An American Boy, a Chinese School, and the Global Race to Achieve. Little Soldiers was written by the author. Her name is Lenora Chu. And one of the reasons why I absolutely adore this book, of which I read with some other VIP Kid teachers probably a few years ago, is because it does a beautiful job of expressing some of the things that we just don't get to see. You know, when you go into the classroom and you teach your students, you have the opportunity to see them in a 25-minute snippet. It's a small part of their life. But there are so many other things involved to actually being able to do our jobs correctly. If we want to be effective in teaching our students, it's probably a good idea that we have a clue what their life is like. If you're newer to teaching online and you're newer to teaching with VIP Kid, then something you're going to notice is these children are not like your children. These children are not like the children you've taught in the American school system. So having the opportunity to take a deep dive into what their life is like, what happens before my 25-minute class starts? What happens after my 25-minute class starts? Why are these parents so intent on getting and starting their students, their children, so early in English education? Why do I have 3-year-olds in my level 1 class? Why are these kids crying over the fact that they received a 95 on a test? These are things that can help us, when we know about them, to become better teachers. So I wanted to read this book, and if you haven't heard it, if you haven't read it, I would highly suggest checking it out. But I hope that you all will enjoy this book reading, and maybe it'll give you something to listen to in the background that just might give you a tidbit of information that can help improve the way you teach these students in your classroom. Now, I do want to preface this, and I plan on prefacing this in every one of these book readings. I do not know Chinese. And I do remember reading this book, and there was a lot of Chinese words and symbols and whatnot in the book. So I will start this podcast book reading off by saying I apologize for any mispronunciation of words that I read. I'll do the best that I can. So with that being said, this first podcast, I want to just not only introduce the book, but go into the first sections of the book. As I open the book, one of the things I think is really interesting is there is a page that is the words of a song that we'll see a little later in the book, but it's a song that's usually taught in Chinese kindergartens. And it says the song goes like this. I am a little soldier. I practice every day. I raise my binoculars. I see things clearly. I take a wooden gun. Bang, bang, bang. I drive a small gunboat. Boom, boom, boom. I ride as a cavalryman. Go, go, go. I am a little soldier. I practice every day. One, two, one. One, two, one. Let us forward march. Forward march. Obviously, this song that was sung made a huge impact on the author, as she decided that was the perfect title for this book. I want to use this podcast just simply to read the prologue, an introduction to what the author was hoping to get across in this this book. So the prologue starts off as this. The title is The Red Star. It seemed like a good idea at the time. When my little boy was 3 years old, I enrolled him in a state-run public school in Shanghai, China's largest city of 26 million people. We're Americans living and working in China, and the Chinese school system is celebrated for producing some of the world's top academic achievers. We were harried, working parents. I'm a writer. My husband's a broadcast journalist, motivated by thoughts of when in Rome, as well as a desire for a little Chinese-style discipline for our progeny. Our son would also learn Mandarin, the most widely spoken language in the world. Excuse me for thinking, what was not to like? It seemed an easy decision, and 2 blocks from our home in downtown Shanghai was Sun Qingling, the school, as far as posh Chinese urbanites were concerned. Sun Qingling Kindergarten educated the 3 to 6-year-old children of ranking Communist Party officials, wealthy entrepreneurs, real estate magnates, and celebrities. Strolling past on weekends, I sometimes spotted young Chinese parents gazing through the school's entrance gates, as if daydreaming about a limitless future for their child. Inside a culture where the early years are considered so critical that there's a common saying, "Don't lose at the starting gate." We figured Sun Qingling was among the best educated experiences China had to offer. A transformation began almost immediately. After the school year began, I noticed my normally rambunctious toddler developing into a proper little pupil. Rainy faithfully greeted his teacher with, "Lao Shi, Zao!" "Good morning, teacher." He began heeding the teacher's every command, patiently waiting his turn in lines, and performing little duties around the house when asked. He also began picking up Mandarin, along with a dose of what the culture valued, hard work and academics. One day, Rainey tried to decipher the meaning of a Chinese phrase he'd heard in the classroom. "What does Kong Ming mean?" he asked me, large brown eyes wide. "Kong Ming means smart, Rainey," I responded. "Oh, good. I want to be smart," he said, bobbing his head, wrinkling his nose. "What does K-I mean?" "That means cute," I said, and his eyes widened. "Oh, I don't want to be cute. I want to be smart," Rainey said. One afternoon, he emerged from school with a shiny red star plastered to his forehead. "Who gave you that star?" I asked my son. "My teacher. I was good in school," Rainey chirped, glancing up at me as I studied his face. "What do you get a red star for?" I ventured, always curious about his classroom environment. "Do you get it if you run fast?" Rainey laughed, a hearty guffaw that emanated from his tiny belly and up through his throat, as if I'd just uttered the most ridiculous thing he'd ever heard. "Mom, I never get a star for running in the classroom," he said, smirking, large brown eyes dancing. "I get it for sitting still." Sitting still? I immediately recognized the error of my assumptions. In America, a student might be rewarded for extraordinary effort or performance, for rising ahead above the rest. In China, you get a star for blending in, and for doing as you're told. It was America's celebrity culture versus China's model citizen. Standing out versus fitting in. Individual excellence versus the merit of collective behavior. The Chinese way was certainly familiar to me, the daughter of Chinese immigrants to America. Yet I'm also a product of U.S. public schools and their culture of personal choice. And as a parent, I wanted good habits instilled for the right reasons and delivered with a firm but feather-like touch. I began to wonder, were Rainey's teachers instilling the right values? "Why do you sit? Do they make you sit at school? Do you have to sit?" I asked Rainey, my voice increasing in pitch and speed with each query. But my rapid-fire questions were too much for a 3-year-old. My husband, Rob, told me it sounded as if I were saying, "Are your human rights being violated?" A few weeks later, Rainey suddenly announced at dinner, over stir-fried tofu, "Let's not talk while we're eating." "Where did you get that idea?" I said immediately, on the case. "Did the teacher say that?" On this, Rob was also incredulous. "So you can't speak during lunch, Rainey?" "No. Bebe and Meme were talking, and the teacher said, 'Be quiet.' Sometimes the teachers are angry to us," Rainey said, as Rob shook his head. "Some of the fondest memories from my Texas childhood come from the school lunch table. There, we learned to barter peanut butter for ham sandwiches, negotiate play dates and Friday night meetups, and collect votes for student council elections. And we forged friendships with as much noise as we could muster." Rob also came out of American schools, and I gather he had trouble imagining his own son being subjected to silence over salami. Or in this case, soybeans. Cultivating a superstar student in China, I'd come to learn, starting with impulse control, at an early age. Jammed into rows alongside his 27 Chinese classmates, planted in a miniature chair, my son had learned to arrange his hands on its corresponding knee, back erect and feet positioned in parallel. He learned never to squirm in his seat or allow a foot out of place, for there was no faster way to draw a teacher's ire. He understood he shouldn't ever touch the student next to him, talk when the teacher was talking, or stand up for water without permission. Above all, he learned the last thing he wanted was to draw attention to himself. The Red Star was his reward for sitting mute in a chair, and my son proved a stellar trainee. Though Rainey's toddler talk came out in halting sentences, at home he was clear about communicating one thing. The sticker would not be removed. Rainey brandished the Red Star at the dinner table, forehead tilted proudly toward the ceiling. He wore it during soccer practice and at a classmate's birthday party. He even refused to peel it off when I tried to wash his face. "No, Mom! Don't touch! Don't touch!" he'd yelp as we readied him for bedtime. Off to bed he marched, red sticker intact. Were we unwittingly engaged in a battle over our son's mind? "Should we be concerned?" I found myself saying out loud. "Don't worry about it," my husband would respond, though sometimes I saw his forehead furrow too. I couldn't help but worry. Strolling through my Shanghai neighborhood, I observed Chinese children who were proper in public, polite to elders and peers, and orderly in the background. I sauntered past the neighborhood elementary school at 3 p.m. on weekdays to see parents and grandparents waiting patiently in a pickup line that snaked around the block. Education here is a family affair. It was no stretch to imagine these children growing up to be disciplined geniuses, respected the world over. But what, if anything, were they giving up? A journalistic curiosity kicked in as I began to seek answers by watching closely and asking the right questions and pursuing experts with more knowledge than I had. As a daily reporter in New York, Minnesota, and California, I'd always defaulted to this approach. And although Chinese society seemed to frown upon independent inquiry, I was driven by a powerful motivating force, parental anxiety. Ironically, 4 months after Rob, Rainey, and I had arrived in China in 2010, the country posted some impressive education news. Shanghai teenagers scored tops in the world in math, reading, and science, according to a global student assessment test named PISA, Program for International Student Assignment. In their exam debut, students in my newly adopted city had beat out peers in nearly 70 countries, the United States and the UK finishing in the middle of the pack. The result shocked the education policy world. "The Shanghai secret," trumpeted the New York Times. President Obama declared it a Sputnik moment, and the president of Yale marveled in a speech that China was building its own version of an American Ivy League, creating the largest higher education sector in the world in merely a decade's time. Meanwhile, media headlines continued to broadcast China's galloping economic juggernaut. Not only was China muscling the rest of the world onto the sidelines, but was also out-educating the West. What I was reading in the newspapers didn't exactly sync with my experience on the ground. Just as I began looking into the school life of these super-achieving Chinese kids, I started to notice troubling signs in our son, such as a habit of obeisance that trickled into other aspects of his life. One day, a classmate's mother asked him if he liked singing. "I don't like singing, but if you want me to do it, I'll do it," he responded. Other days, Rainey would recite Communist Party songs, singing praise unto the motherland. I would try to convince myself that our home environment was just as important as that of school. Meanwhile, I began to watch my son carefully, as if I'd developed a sixth sense, especially tuned to subservience, and a seventh of brainwashing. I suddenly recalled a conversation I'd had with a European expat friend who had pulled her daughter out of Chinese school. "I did not raise my daughter to be a robot or a people pleaser," she fumed. I noticed the Chinese around me had anxieties of their own, but of a different kind. A long-lost but now rediscovered Shanghainese cousin had begun frantic arrangements for the daughter's primary school entrance interviews, enrolling her in a fearsome after-school activity called Math Olympiad. A high school kid I'd met began marathon preparations for the National College Entrance Exam. A rural Chinese woman who'd babysat Rainey for a year suddenly hightailed it home to Hubei province. The son she'd left behind in the countryside was struggling in the run up to high school entrance exams, and now he had nowhere to live. "The government is raising my house to clear the way for a building project," the woman said through tears. "One of hundreds of millions of Chinese migrants blessed by job opportunity, yet simultaneously cursed by the devastation rapid economic change can bring." Rob and I had headed to China for what seemed like limitless opportunity, but the Chinese themselves seemed uneasy about the change happening around them. I wondered about the contradictions I was sensing. Was the obedience I observed in Rainey part of the Chinese secret to academic success? Was the Chinese education system really pumping out robots, or were their students actually getting a superior education? Although the world seemed to hail China's march toward global superdom, are Chinese methods really what the West should be measuring itself against, much less emulating? These questions surfaced again and again, and before long I began taking a pen and paper everywhere I went, jotting notes as I looked for answers. For several years, I trailed young Chinese and talked to teachers, principals, and education experts. I dropped in on schools in the United States and China and traveled deep into the Chinese countryside to look into reports of devastating poverty and inequality. I pored over research studies and volunteer taught at a Shanghai kindergarten. I was certain my reporting would open a peephole into a massive country that seemed formidable from the outside, it was quietly struggling to make sense of its newfound standing in the world. And it would also illuminate the best way forward for Rainey in his own schooling. Early on, I instinctively understood my family would need to bend and be flexible to find our compass. In fact, we'd be required to deliver practice tests before breakfast. As my journalistic quest began to calm my anxiety as a parent, one important lesson became clear. If we opened our minds, we just might reap the benefits of rearing our child in a second culture and educating him the Chinese way, while hopefully retaining our Western sense of individuality. Ours would be a journey that would require grit, more than a few leaps of faith, as well as an outward respect for everything our newfound culture would throw in our direction, including bribery by Red Star sticker. China would have it no other way. And that's the end of the prologue. The next podcast will begin our first chapter of this book. I hope that you enjoyed the reading. Please feel free to reach out to me. Let me know what you think about this podcast idea. Otherwise, thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you in the next podcast.